Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, greenwashing culture, how journalism, the entertainment industry, and museums impact the environment. But first, raising big money is a relatively new phenomenon in academia. How did science, government, and industry get so entrenched with one another, and what has it meant for scholarly research? Michael Hiltzik joins us to talk about his latest book, Big Science: Ernest Lawrence and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Michael Hiltzik. It is great to have you back with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm curious first why you decided to do this particular book. It seems like a departure from your past books and subjects. Why Big Science?
It's a departure from some of my recent books, but not necessarily from my trend line. A number of things came together at just the right moment. First, of course, I was looking for a new subject. I had just finished and published a book on the New Deal. I've always been interested in technology and science, and I've always had sort of a hobbyist interest in things like physics and quantum mechanics and things like that. And when you read enough in that field, it isn't long before you encounter the name of Ernest Lawrence. And that's also true when, as I was doing, you cover higher education in the U.S., because higher education means a lot of money being spent on big scientific projects, and he was the father of that trend. So he's often mentioned both as the father of, as I said, big science, but also as the father of modern physics because of his invention of the cyclotron. So this was going to enable me to write about the politics of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and the war, and physics, and technology, and to revive interest and knowledge about this very important scientific figure in the U.S. that most people had really forgotten about.
One of the things that was really remarkable was essentially Lawrence's role in transforming science from what you call small science to what we now call big science. Can you talk about the difference in what it was before Lawrence and then what we are talking about when we say big science?
Sure. Well, there was a continuum of how scientific research, particularly in chemistry and physics, was being done, and especially in physics at the time. We're talking about the very late 20s and the beginning of the 30s. And the older generation of physicists, these are people like Sir Ernest Rutherford and Marie Curie, had accomplished incredible things with the tools that nature gave them. They were using alpha ray emissions from thimblefuls of radium and other radioactive materials, and using those tools, they had discovered radioactivity and X-rays. And they had discovered the neutron, and they had figured out the internal structure of the atom itself. But they also understood that they had basically come to the end of that process, that to delve further into the atomic nucleus, they were going to need projectiles and tools of much greater energies, and that those were not going to be available from natural minerals, that it was going to require using man's ingenuity build up those energies. And it was Rutherford himself who said, I would like to see an apparatus that can give me 10 electron volts and yet fit in a comfortably sized room. So he sort of set out that challenge to the younger generation, and Lawrence was there at the right moment. He had the right intuitions and the right instinct, and he discovered the way to do that, and that was the cyclotron. It was a way of placing energies on the projectile, in his case, initially protons, and driving them to higher energies without trying to put the energy onto the apparatus itself. And this was a really radical new concept, and he was able to put it into action.
The original cyclotron was really small compared to what it developed into. Tell us a little about what the cyclotron did, the size of it, and then its future, like the Hadron Collider, for example. So walk us through what it did and its size, and then its progeny.
Sure. The cyclotron concept was based on the fact that if you send a charged particle through a magnetic field, its path will curve. So Lawrence understood that if you send a proton, which has a positive charge of 1, through a magnetic field, you can twist it into a spiral, and that allows you to jolt it with new energies every time it crosses the same electrode gap. Now, that was the concept. It took a couple of years for him to actually get it to work, and his first cyclotron fit in the palm of his hand. It looked like a flask, a glass or metal flask that had been run over by a truck. It was slathered with red sealing wax to keep a vacuum inside it, and it cost less than $100 in material. Once he got that or its next generations working, every time he got new energies, he raised new questions about what these could do. So every generation of the cyclotron had to be bigger, it had to be more powerful. Inevitably, it was more expensive, and over a period of really less than a decade, he had gone from that little palm-sized unit to a cyclotron that needed a building to be built for it in a ravine above the Berkeley campus, and that was going to cost more than $1 million. This, of course, was a process that soon outstripped the ability of a university to pay for even a consortium of universities, and that's why Lawrence began to turn to research foundations and the government and eventually industry as well. And that's how big science came about. Forward to the present day, the Large Hadron Collider is the largest atom smasher in the world. It occupies a tunnel that's 17 miles in circumference. It's buried under the border between France and Switzerland, and it cost $9 billion to build. And what it's got in it is several cyclotrons and synchrocyclotrons and other offspring of Lawrence's original concept. So you can see sort of the evolution of these machines over time.
The Large Hadron Collider is really the essence of big, which you noted in your book titled Big Science, of course, that took, 25 years, I think you said, $10 billion. How can we understand just how big this really is?
Well, I think we can understand it by, there's actually a photograph in my book of a man standing inside the tunnel of the Large Hadron Collider. And of course, he's dwarfed by the machinery around him, and you compare that to a unit that fit in the palm of somebody's hand. And, of course, the energies that these devices can produce today are unimaginable. They were even unimaginable to somebody with the imagination of an Ernest Lawrence, who himself was thinking way ahead of his own contemporaries. But you now need those energies to essentially create or to see at least the signs of new particles that are themselves the building block of subatomic particles and the atom and the world we live in.
I think one of the most important results that we saw from Lawrence was, as you mentioned, the military-industrial complex, the bombs, the World War II, but also the academy. He was the first to really go after all this money and convince the government to put its resources into science, and then the development of big science as an institution in of itself. So I wonder if we could walk through each of these. Perhaps we should start with, you mentioned the first time a scientist had started going to foundations, going to the government. Tell us a little bit about how he did this and how it developed into today.
Yeah, I think that scientific research was sort of lucky in having a person like Lawrence in that place at that time. His personality really lent itself to this sort of, to being an impresario, to being a ringleader and a manager. He was a prototypical CEO of a research center. He was amiable. He was smart. He knew how to talk to university presidents and foundation chairmen and industrial CEOs very easily. It may have had a lot to do with his upbringing as a small-town boy in rural South Dakota. He was very American. He had an air about him that was very different from the stern European mien of physicists of the past. So his personality really lent itself to his ability to do that. And, of course, he had this other quality, which is that when he promised that he would achieve something, he almost always delivered on that promise. So if he was going to the Rockefeller Foundation or the Macy Foundation, which was doing a lot of funding of medical research, and he could say, look, you know, this is my goal, this is what I'm going to do. They could look at his record, and they could see that he actually had achieved what he had promised the last time around. And, you know, he was somebody who always had the next machine on the drawing board when the last one was still being built. So he brought these people along with him. His enthusiasm was really infectious. And, of course, the fact that he actually could deliver was very, very important at this stage when he's out there on the very leading edge of physics. Now, the point came when the needs for his technology really went beyond even what foundations could do, what corporations could do. And at that moment, we were about to enter the war, and the government was in the mode of becoming the most important patron of basic scientific research. And there was Lawrence. He was very friendly with the scientific leadership of the government at the time, and he moved very smoothly into the patronage of the government from industry and foundations and universities.
I got the sense from reading your book that this kind of raised eyebrows at the time, that a lot of scientists weren't really comfortable with this cozy kind of relationship and their concerns about strings attached. What are the ethical concerns that were raised at the time, and integrate them into what you see today?
There was sort of a series of phases. You have to remember that when this process really began, first of all, when he was dealing with universities and foundations, there weren't a lot of ethical concerns raised by other scientists. They understood that these were entities devoted to basic science. They were willing to allow the scientists that they were funding to follow their own noses. At the point that he began to get involved with the military, we were entering the war, and most of the scientific community, particularly the physics community, was very interested in doing this sort of work because a lot of them had come from Germany and Austria. They were very, very panicky about the thought that Hitler would get his hands on the secrets of nuclear fission and create a bomb that they knew was at least plausible and feasible. So at the point that Lawrence began to develop his relationship with the government and the military, the rest of the scientific community was okay with that. They had a job to do. It was an urgent job, and Lawrence helped organize the Manhattan Project. He played a key role in the scientific management of that project. And I think most of his colleagues had faith that he knew what he was doing and that he would protect them from political interference, and he did. Now, that became harder to do in the post-war period when many of the scientists who had worked on the Manhattan Project began to have second thoughts about the work they had done, no matter how urgent and important they thought it was at the time, and especially once the U.S. government began to get very interested in the hydrogen bomb. This was a new technology. Many of the physicists who had worked on the atomic bomb were very uncomfortable with it. They viewed it as a weapon that would be good only for genocide or as a psychological menace. Many of them did not want to work on it, but it was Lawrence who kept pushing it ahead. And that, I think, led to a lot of doubts about the propriety of working with Lawrence and with the government at that time. The government in the post-war years was much more interested in attaching strings to its patronage. A lot of physicists who wanted to move back into civilian life were very uncomfortable with that. So you began to see this real split within the scientific community about these relationships, really starting after 1945.
There were some problems, of course, too, in his science. He got sort of busted at one of the conferences that dealt with the deuteron and having contaminated the results. What did that mean in this big picture?
We're going back to the 1930s now, and this was a period in which Lawrence himself was sort of learning how to be a scientist. I think it's something that many scientists have to go through. They have to learn how to divorce their thrill with the technology that they have on hand from the need to actually come up with results. Lawrence and his team at Berkeley in the early days, they were really focused on building up the technology, on building bigger cyclotrons that were more and more capable. And in that era, actual scientific research often took a back seat to this desire to build the machine. As I said, in the radiation lab, which was Lawrence's lab at Berkeley, you could be forgiven for not bringing a scientific project to fruition, but you could not be forgiven for missing your shift tending the cyclotron. A lot of scientists just, you know, could not deal with that. He lost a few very talented men, but many saw that once the cyclotron was perfected, the ability to do research would be great. But in the process, Lawrence got a lot of things wrong. His team missed a couple of very important developments. They missed the discovery of artificial radiation, which was discovered by Marie Curie, even though they had the best equipment to make this discovery. And the deuteron affair, which you just mentioned, involved what Lawrence thought was his discovery of what was going on when a deuteron, that's the nucleus of a helium atom, strikes a target within the cyclotron. He used his findings to develop a theory about the weight of the neutron, which other scientists, much more experienced scientists, especially at Cambridge University in England, thought was wrong. And then he presented his results at a very important scientific conference in Brussels, and he was shown to be wrong. He had to climb down. His reputation was really at risk because experienced researchers thought that he had been incompetent in doing this. He had tried to claim results that were not supported by the data. And I think he learned a lot from that. He learned humility, certainly, and he learned really the need to do the actual research much more rigorously. And that, I think, was a turning point for his lab. And after that, they didn't make that mistake again.
So let's bring in Oppenheimer now. He was, as you described, the great theorist, whereas Lawrence was a great experimentalist. So we're fast forwarding now. You said their relationship was quite enigmatic, but also probably the most responsible for developing big science. How would you describe that relationship before Oppenheimer got into some trouble?
Robert Oppenheimer got to Berkeley a year or so after Ernest did. And as you said, Oppenheimer was probably the most talented physics theorist in the United States at the time. Lawrence's grasp of theory was not always very strong, but he was a great experimentalist, and of course Oppenheimer was useless around a machine. So they had a symbiotic relationship. They had a great relationship. And at the beginning of this time, they were very, very close friends. Lawrence's first son, Robert, was named after Oppenheimer. The family socialized together. They were very, very close. But they were very different. And in fact, a lot of their colleagues spent half their lives trying to figure out what drew Ernest Lawrence and Robert Oppenheimer together, and then spent half their lives trying to figure out what led to their very, very bitter breakup later in their lives. As you said, it was an odd relationship, started out very warm, it ended very bitter. But at the key moments from the 1930s and into the 1940s, it was very, very close. In fact, it was Lawrence who nominated Oppenheimer to run the lab that would become Los Alamos under the Manhattan Project. And he even had to vouch for Oppenheimer when the U.S. Army said, you know, Oppenheimer's a leftist, we're not sure he's not a communist. It was Lawrence who stepped forward and said, I will keep him under control. If he runs off the rails, I will be there to fix it. And that was enough for General Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, to basically sign off on Oppenheimer's appointment.
Eventually, his security clearance was revoked, Oppenheimer's. So what happened for the revocation to occur?
Well, that's the tragedy of Robert Oppenheimer. After the war, he not only opposed the development of the hydrogen bomb, but he spoke out against it. He became a great campaigner against nuclear proliferation and the development of thermonuclear weapons, and of course a very respected one because of his role in the war. He had been sort of a shy, mumbling figure at the beginning of the 30s when he and Lawrence first began their friendship, and he had developed into essentially a world figure, world-famous physicist, scientist, and statesman. Now, in opposing the hydrogen bomb, Oppenheimer ran afoul of a man named Louis Strauss, who was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission under Truman and Eisenhower, and was a fanatic fan of developing the hydrogen bomb. Strauss was the type of person who, if you disagreed with him, he at first thought you were an idiot and then concluded you were a traitor, and that's the way he viewed Oppenheimer. So it was Strauss who really started this campaign to revoke Robert Oppenheimer's security clearance and stage essentially a trial of Oppenheimer to revoke that clearance, in which physicists of great renown from all over the country essentially had to take sides, either for Oppenheimer or against him. The real tragedy in this relationship, I think, is that almost every physicist in the U.S., certainly every physicist who had worked in the Manhattan Project, was on Oppenheimer's side and defended him at this trial. The only people who were against him were Ernest Lawrence and his team at Berkeley. And they came very close to testifying at this procedure against Oppenheimer, and then decided that it was better for them if they just stood down and they didn't testify at all.
So do you think ultimately it was politics that divided Lawrence and Oppenheimer?
It was chiefly politics, but I think their personalities and their different lifestyles really played into this and played an important role. I think if they had political disagreements, but they were two different people than they were, I don't think it would have been as bitter a breakup as it became. You have to really think about how fundamentally different in personality these two people were. Lawrence, as I said, was a small-town boy. He was married to the same woman all his life. Robert Oppenheimer was a New Yorker, a New York City born and bred. He had been trained in Europe. He had gotten an education of a sophistication that Lawrence didn't have. He was sort of a boulevardier. He was a womanizer. He was married twice. He had a lot of affairs, including one with the wife of a very close friend of Lawrence that Lawrence thought very bitterly about. So you had all these elements. Oppenheimer was into politics. Lawrence tried to stay away from politics as much as he could, especially the sort of leftist socialist politics that Oppenheimer espoused. So you had all these elements, and when you add onto it this fundamental disagreement about a project that Lawrence was committed to and that Oppenheimer was publicly speaking out against, it was an explosive formula, and it really did end in serious breach.
Let's talk also about Lawrence's influence on medicine with his brother and with Harvey Williams Cushing. They really contributed a lot to this field of nuclear medicine. Tell us about that.
Well, a couple of things came together. First of all, Ernest was very sensitive to waves of funding in the scientific community. There was a period early in the development of the cyclotron when funding for hard physics was drying up. This is foundation funding. But funding for medical research was surging. Now, Ernest Lawrence was always on the lookout for patronage. He needed a lot of money to build his machine. So he began to think harder about what the cyclotron could do, what the technology could do for medical science. Now, his younger brother, John, was a medical doctor who was also interested in this field. So they came together and they worked together to develop what became the field of nuclear medicine. John Lawrence was one of the first professors of nuclear medicine. He got the appointment at the University of California at what was then Berkeley's Medical School, which was in San Francisco, which is now UC San Francisco. And they worked together to develop the capabilities of using radiation to diagnose and cure disease in ways that are still being used today. A lot of the machines, diagnostic equipment that's used today was pioneered by Ernest and John Lawrence at this very, very early stage. At the same time, Ernest was beginning to use the cyclotron to develop new isotopes that were not seen in the natural world, that he could create by bombarding existing elements. Some of these became very important diagnostic and curative tools in medicine as well.
You opened your book talking about the Higgs boson and how it has come out of big science. If you were going to say the other really big contributions that have come from this, essentially from this guy who transformed science and wedded it with government and big foundations, what would you say the other big contributions have been?
Well, I'd say if you look around, big science is all around us. It was critical in developing not only nuclear science, but also advances in biology. The Human Genome Project, that's a big science project. Addressing climate change, that's going to require big science. If we define big science as capital-intensive interdisciplinary research at a very basic level, then you can see that there's so much around us that depends on this paradigm. But at the same time, of course, it unleashed the destructive force of the nucleus as well. So I quoted in my book Raymond Fosdick, who was the chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, who funded Ernest's largest cyclotron. This was in the late 1930s and early 1940s, who said, "We can't say science itself is good or evil. We can only talk about what humankind makes of this knowledge and these achievements." And I think that's the way we have to look at big science. It really, as I also quoted James Franck, who was a German emigre physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project and who knew Lawrence and who knew all this technology, he said, look, what we have done with big science is we have brought science past the point in which scientists can any longer disavow responsibility for their discoveries. There's just too much at stake. The destructive power of what we have discovered is greater than all the discoveries of mankind put together in the past. So I think big science has brought science to that point where scientists have to think about what the implications are of what they do. And this is very difficult both for science and for society at large, and I'm not sure we have solved that problem yet. But all we can say is that it's big science that still fulfills man's undying quest for knowledge in ever more important ways.
And it's also transformed the academy itself.
Well, it definitely has. The need to raise money, to marshal resources, and to manage these huge teams and huge funds really has turned university professors and university presidents into impresarios and promoters and CEOs. It's taken them away from the work of actually doing science in a way that I think has made many people uncomfortable, and rightly so. But I think that trend is only going to continue because big science itself drives its leaders to raise more money and build more to make science ever bigger, to answer ever bigger questions.
Michael Hiltzig, thank you for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm happy to be here.
Michael Hiltzig is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the author of 6 books, including the one we've been talking about, Big Science, Ernest Lawrence, and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. When we come back, greenwashing culture, how journalism, the entertainment industry, and museums impact the environment. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. With us is Toby Miller. He's a professor of media and the author of 29 books, including Greenwashing Culture. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. Toby, it's great to have you back here with us.
Thanks so much, Maria. Great to be with you.
And what a fantastic book about culture and greenwashing. I had originally planned to start with the way you started the book with this public relations firm, Edelman. But I think what we should do is talk about culture first and what exactly you mean when you talk about culture. How can we understand it and its effects on society?
How much time do you have? So I guess there are normally two ways in which people conceive of culture, Maria. One would be anthropological or ethnographic, and that is, in a sense, the way in which we live our lives, the way in which when you and I wait for a bus in LA, We know that we have to stand in line, and we know that the person at the front of the line gets on the bus first. All of those things through to, you know, even more mundane elements, but that are quite important, like how you lay a table, where you put the knife and the fork, how these things are agreed, how we learn them, how we organize our daily rituals, that when we go to church or when we're in class, we don't just start speaking whenever we feel like it. We wait until others have spoken and asked for us to speak. That kind of question is addressed by that form of culture. And then there's the more aesthetic or artistic form of culture, which is where those ritualistic norms of daily life are inscribed. So, for example, when we read romance fiction, a Harlequin novel, or a Milton Boone novel, depending on where you are, or a money, sex, power novel with raised writing on the paperback cover, if you still read paperbacks, then we learn about heterosexual mating rituals. And that's done with a particular style that's determined by the genre, by the publisher, by the language, by the kind of readership. Now, as you can see, the distinction I'm drawing between the anthropological and the aesthetic breaks down because, of course, when we read the Harlequin or Milton Boone novel or the Money, Sex, Power novel with the raised writing on the cover, that novel is both addressing the kind of everyday norms of ritual and it is also textualizing them and teaching them. So the anthropological and the aesthetic come together. When that happens, for example, in the form of a museum, the museum or the art gallery is both offering us norms about how to comport ourselves as visitors to a museum and ideas about history or behavior at the same time as it is creating aesthetic understandings about architecture, about beauty, and about truth.
So in a way, it's sort of conveying an ideology as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that ideology, particularly, say, in the space of a museum, is all about, or can be about, how things in the past should be understood, but we've transcended them and now we're somewhere else. I mean, if you think about the current controversy in the US over the tearing down of statues commemorating the Confederacy, I was living in New Orleans for the first half of this year and was present when one of those statues was removed. That is about trying to say we have a past which we have transcended, and then the issue becomes, do you want to celebrate the loss of that past or do you want to criticize it? So there are very definite ideological components, absolutely.
And so when you wrote this book, one of the theorists that you spent some time on, actually a few of them, were Antonio Gramsci and the Frankfurt School. They argued that the culture industry is a force of anti-enlightenment or mass deception. And then you kind of sprang from there into more present-day theory. Do you agree with them about the anti-enlightenment mass deception of those theorists, or do you think that it's evolved to another stage?
That's a really great question. All your questions are great and quite penetrating. I want to sit on the fence and have a bit each way. Basically, what Adorno and Horkheimer in the Dialectic of the Enlightenment were saying was that regardless of content, the industrialized form of manufacturing culture, which they encountered when they moved to Santa Monica during the war, was creating movies and radio programs in the same way that Detroit was manufacturing cars. In other words, that there was a standardized norm that allowed for a certain amount of difference in order to differentiate different radio shows or Hollywood movies, but that this relied very much on a standard mode of production with minimal disruption to techniques and minimal innovation, and that that was the enemy of what they saw as the great task and gift of the Enlightenment in Kantian terms, namely, and obviously this takes you down the path of German philosophy, the task of making us reconsider ourselves as projects, taking critical distance from ourselves to see who we really are, holding up what might be an unflattering glass to ourselves and saying, I or we as a nation or this family could be better if we did the following things. But that great task of the Enlightenment and of culture was being done in by industrialized modes. Now, as I've indicated with reference to for example, romance fiction or the money, sex, power novel with Ray's writing on the cover, I don't think that that highly industrialized model necessarily fails to encourage us to engage in critical self-reflection. And lots of ethnographic studies of things like romance fiction have shown that for many heterosexual women readers, the great gift of this kind of cultural production, however industrialized and quasi-uniform it may be, is that when it comes to conversation about their lives, readers of this material, the same thing applies to lots of self-help writing, manage then to take that kind of story, be it fictional or pop psychological, and allow it to become a measuring stick against their own lives. Dissatisfaction at the lack of love in their heterosexual relationships, the dissatisfaction at male-female roles, all kinds of things. So yes, I think Adorno and Horkheimer were really onto something when they alerted us to the need to look at what happens when you industrialize culture and manufacture it in the same way as an automobile. But no, I think they were wrong in suggesting that as a consequence, the products, the texts of that kind of culture industry necessarily negate our capacity to engage in critical self-reflection.
Let's turn to your main thesis of the most current book, which is greenwashing. And you spent quite a bit of time documenting and reiterating how much trouble we're in as a planet and how much we're contributing to the destruction of this planet, simultaneous with the greenwashing of the culture industry, so to speak, movies, journalism, museums. Maybe we need to talk about the effects first of the film and TV industry, journalism, and museums. What is the environmental impact?
Well, let's start by saying that most of us would probably assume, as did I until about 15 years ago, that these were comparatively green sectors, by contrast, say, with mineral extraction or aerospace or transportation by car or lots and lots of other manufacturing and extractive industries, and even probably agriculture. And in fact, lots of these sectors advertise themselves as green. And when you see post-industrial societies trying to remake themselves, they often talk about how there will be a green future as they move towards the service or ternary sector, which includes things like the areas you've just mentioned. However, that's not the case. For example, there's a very powerful study of Los Angeles and how within that city, one that is notably polluted by the vast use of automobiles on an everyday basis and trucks and so on, actually, in terms of contribution to pollution, the film industry and the television industry, the production end of things, is a greater contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in Los Angeles than transportation. And if you look at the museum sector, you see that one of the things that lots of museums do, whether it's the Tate Modern in London or the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in California, is that they engage in two kinds of greenwashing. The first is that they provide an alibi, one might ironically call it a smokescreen, for major polluters like, say, BP or Shell, in both those cases, who draw upon the goodwill given to them in the public mind by sponsoring blockbuster exhibits or buildings at those famous museums in order to appear as though they are benign entities, part of their search for what they call the social license to operate, so that beyond having commercial and state rights to drill, for example, they also have public acquiescence to do so. At the same time as frequently the museums themselves engage in polluting activity. It can mean, for example, Google searches that are undertaken by administrators and conservators at the museums. Most Google searches are undertaken not necessarily by Google's element itself, but by those who are using it through coal-powered technology. So there's a very dirty coal element to much of our online work that we do. And also because, for example, if you're putting on a major dinner for big donors, then not only are you inviting them using technologies that are very dirty, but, for example, lots of them, and I've witnessed this myself at the Art Institute of Chicago, for example, have their chauffeurs idling the limousines for 4 or 5 hours so they can leave whenever they feel like it as they prepare to sign or not sign the hefty checks that museums are hoping to receive. So there are all those factors that are at play. There's both the question in the museum sector of providing cover for greenwashing and doing your own greenwashing. When it comes to journalism, there are, on the one hand, certainly the kinds of impacts that come from all the one-click-away-lies-all-of-truth elements of contemporary journalism, where instead of pounding the street in rubber soles to interview people and actually find stuff out in person, many, many journalists are relying entirely on the internet without any sense of how clean and green their own form of energy is, or that of the various routes that the internet takes us on as it speeds around the world to find stuff out and communicate it. And also there are various aspects of journalism that are innately involved in pollution. A famous and very important one is travel journalism. Probably all of us have enjoyed some very good articles by some excellent writers, for example, in the New York Times, about what it's like to go to a certain tourist destination, perhaps even an eco-tourist destination. But of course, what happens is that those writers generally have their airfares paid by the tourism entities that are trying to attract the coverage. They rarely include the carbon imprint of their own journalism, nor do they generally include such issues in the coverage that they provide us with. If you look at all the major journalism federations and unions around the world, even those that themselves are dedicated to reporting on the environmental impact of different industries rarely engage in any kind of audit of their own carbon footprint. So those are some of the ways in those three sectors you mentioned that I think there's a real problem that needs to be addressed. And it's a problem that isn't obvious to us. We tend to assume, certainly I did, that these are very, very green sectors. To the extent that we know, they're really not.
You actually laid out quite a bit of the environmental destruction within this book, you know, talking about, for example, the health effects of the plastics and wires and monitors that are smashed and dismantled, and this informal economy of rag pickers. How can you help us understand how all of this accumulates and what it really means?
Take a place like Australia, and it, of course, has about 23 million people. It has more than 23 million disposed of cell phones, or mobile phones, as they call them there. One of the problems that a lot of us face in terms of the technologies that you and I and our colleagues at the station are using today is that we're used to the idea that these large or small gadgets work and then suddenly they don't and they have to be disposed of. What we're not used to is that they have polluting components, A, at the level of the extraction of minerals to create them, B, at the level of their manufacture, C, at the level of our use, and D, in terms of their post-consumer life. What do I mean by that? Some folks may be aware of the fact that central processing units rely, inter alia, on coltan, which is a composite mineral that basically comes from Democratic Republic of Congo, which, as listeners will be aware, is the site of a horrendous civil war in which millions have died and many more have been raped and injured. A lot of those deaths, a lot of those violations have occurred as part of the conflict minerals industry, which is how the coltan that's in the middle of the cell phone that I'm holding now to my ear to speak to you with is powered in part. So there, and in addition to those human costs, there is a massive impact on the local environment when it comes to pollution of water, air, and earth as a consequence of that extractive work. So there's one example. Another example is at the point of manufacturing. The world's biggest television manufacturer is Mexico, closely followed by China and Vietnam. They basically corner the market. And because Mexico is a democracy, we know a lot more about the experiences of those working in it than we do in the two other nation states. In Mexico, there is extraordinary pollution in the maquiladoras just south of the border with the United States at the point where television sets are created. Then, of course, they come over the border. Let's stick with TVs again for a moment. One of the things about the beautiful new flat-screen digital TVs is that they are energy hogs, and they are also quite hot. So in addition to the energy that they use, which is decreasing as the manufacturers become more concerned about such matters, they also encourage many viewers, without thinking about the fact, to be, for example, increasing their use of air conditioning or their use of fans in order to cool the houses and other places in which they're watching the television. Then when a new model comes along, what happens? Well, when we got rid of our old flat screen analogic TVs, where did the hundreds and hundreds of millions, almost 300 million in the US alone, go? Well, they went to West Africa, to Latin America, to Southeast Asia, illegally in most cases, where they were ripped apart, normally by rag pickers, whom you mentioned earlier, i.e. people in the informal sector, in search of the dozens of valuable minerals within them, but without adequate protection against the health risks created to them as informal recyclers by the carcinogenic gases and other properties that are within them. In addition to the horrendous health impact on those people, in addition to all the immediate effects, there are later effects caused from the fact that parts of these recycled television sets, and the same applies to computers and to cell phones and to tablets, are then either buried, in which case they leach into the water table and pollute the soil, or they're burnt, in which case they do the same to the air. So the long-term environmental impacts, as well as the short, medium, and long-term occupational health and safety impacts, are horrendous. Most of us don't think about any of those phases when we engage in the pleasure or the work necessity of utilizing these gadgets. And what we need to do is appreciate that although they may be crucial parts of our lives in terms of family fun or sports enjoyment or going out for the weekend or doing our jobs, they wreak terrible havoc in ways that we can neither see nor hear, but are affecting very materially our lives, our futures, and especially the lives of those in the global south who create the conditions of possibility for our pleasure and our work necessity, and then take responsibility for doing away with them when they've played their part for us.
So let's turn to possible solutions. You argue for a green citizenship, turning more towards a deep ecology where we don't just center on human, we sort of center on the whole picture with the human within it. You see, this is bigger than the nation state. It's got to be supranational. So how would you see this as a possible way of addressing these pretty awful consequences?
One is supposed to end with positive remarks and optimism for the future. You mentioned Gramsci earlier, and he's, of course, famous for many things, not the least of which is quoting Romain Rolland, the French Nobel laureate, who wrote about pessimism of the intelligence, optimism of the will. So this is often wrongly attributed to Gramsci, and the word intelligence is changed to intellect. And one needs both those things. One needs to be looking at the downsides with a serious analytic scrutiny, at the same time as one looks at ways around the problem. And I guess my 25 years living in the United States imbued me a little more with the hopefulness of a Gramsci, as opposed to the horrendous pessimism that my early childhood left me with, by which I simply mean being a teenage Marxist in other countries. So enough of my exciting autobiography. What would this mean? Well, it means recognizing that the stereotype of the environmentalist as the white guy, shaggy-haired, you know, full-bearded, non-hipster, alienated subject who wanders around hugging trees and doesn't connect to issues to do with public policy or commerce or consumption or ordinary people's lives is actually quite wrong. The very significant longitudinal and latitudinal studies of membership of green movements, mostly done in the US, shows that they are cross-class, cross-race, and very cross-geographical. And if you think about some of the ideological objections to environmentalism, you see that it's really a false bifurcation that places environmentalists amongst radicals and anti-environmentalists amongst conservatives. If we turn back the pages to Edmund Burke and his famous negative reflections on the revolution in France in the 18th century, Burke, in objecting to the revolution in France, made one of the most famous remarks that has become a cornerstone of environmental discourse, namely that we have a duty to protect our world, both for our children and for those yet to be born. And that's a long-term conservative tradition. Now, it's warped in the United States by the self-interest of a number of extremely wealthy and powerful corporations and families. But there is a way in which both conservatives and progressives can find common cause in the notion of shepherding our world so that it can be enjoyed and remade by others. So that's one positive note. Another positive note is that there, in addition to being a potentially broad coalition and certainly already a much broader analytic base to environmentalism than we thought, there are some extremely significant moments in the work of non-government organizations, multinational corporations, and states that show the capacity for cooperation across their very different forms of life. To give an example, when it comes to the issues with television sets and telephones and computers that I mentioned, every year Greenpeace puts out a really superb study by its own scientists, often with the cooperation of major corporations, into the green claims and realities of a lot of these gadgets. Similarly, groups involved in militancy in Hong Kong over the working conditions and occupational health and safety of those assembling a lot of our gadgets has been extremely effective in bringing international attention to bear on companies like Foxconn that embark on these kinds of quasi-slave manufacturing protocols. And although the United States is an outlier in the terms of its current administration and that administration's atrocious record on environmentalism, the previous president of France said not long before leaving office, this was François Hollande, we can no longer think of everyday life as a commodity. We have to think of it as something that we look after for the future. So there really are some significant examples abroad of many, many companies, NGOs, and states that are seeking to behave in more responsible ways than we have been used to. There is hope. There is possibility. There is the prospect of a better future.
There were two Latin American examples that you gave ways of approaching that might be worth considering. One was in Ecuador, the Constitution.
That's right. The Ecuadorian Constitution, and remember, this is a state that for the first time has seen significant power given by the electorate to indigenous peoples in the recent past, recognizes the earth, Mother Earth, and it's gendered in that way, as having rights, as requiring constitutional protections in the same way as free speech or immigration or citizenship rights or rights to cultural expression are granted in many other constitutions. That's a really compelling and powerful notion of how we can hold governments to account in the new kind of constitutional world of environmental citizenship. The other example to which you refer is from Colombia, which is where I work 12 weeks of the year and where I am now. Bogota, which is, of course, the capital, very big city, has for years been maintained informally by the aforementioned ragpickers. These are mostly people who are analphabetic, i.e. they can neither write nor read. Some of them are indigenous and may not speak Spanish, which of course is the official and dominant language of the nation state, and so were always excluded from opportunities to bid for the contracts to be the official cleaners of the city. After some fellow travelers from the left and amongst feminism, because most of these informal workers are women, got together and created a legal challenge to that exclusion that says, well, you can't read or write, so you can't sign a contract. The Supreme Court here ultimately decided in their favor. And so they were able to cut in on the contracts that traditionally had been given to the sons and daughters, particularly the sons of the traditional light-skinned oligarchy that still runs this country. And rank pickers are often the most powerless of the most powerless. I gave examples of people who are picking away at the remains of gadgets. But in addition to that, these people are often stereotyped by otherwise good entities like the World Health Organization and other public health researchers and officials as problems because of the huge amount of really dangerous diseases that they suffer from and therefore the costs they impose on public health. They are rarely seen as solidarity entrepreneurs working together for the common good. And that example is an instance of where, along with some fantastic organization of indigenous rag pickers led by Brazilians, but involving people from South Asia, from Southeast Asia and other parts of the world, have seen how they have common cause and can utilize democratic claims in order to better their situation. So again, as you imply, there is real hope and there has been real progress made by them in terms of being able to dynamize and animate environmental citizenship.
The book again is Greenwashing Culture, and Toby Miller is our guest. He's a distinguished professor of media and culture studies. Well, thank you so much for joining us here again on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for giving me this great opportunity.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.